side, slowly looking all around. Hey. She wise guy tried to take him, but they lay dead on the ground. Hey. Bye bye, die pa, die bye. Bye bye, die pa, die. The sound of a gunshot, just a crime. Hey, tell him, hey, tell him. In the yard, there's by Dr. Owl. There's a ranking named Billy Bow. Hey, 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 hey. He's also a top ranking, but in the country, raising cow.
With us on the show today, we have in live, we have the three people from the Climber Camp. We have a continuation of the interviews with Ian McKay about the anarchist FAQ, and then we have Loud Crackle and then No Borders, which, if you're interested, is coming from the laptop. we also have some music, random bits, and yeah, we were supposed to have more people on, but. Yeah, technical problems got in the way, and so yeah, we're gonna maybe have them on a different time. All right.
It's me now, is it? All right, okay. Well, we're here with Climb Campers. It's just Richard, Kate, and Portia. Yeah, how are you? Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for
having
us.
Yeah, yeah. No worries. No worries. I just wanted to start. We're here to talk about Climb Camp, and we don't know where the location is yet specifically, but we know it's within the M25, and I'm just wondering, like. Why was the decision made to have it in the southeast of England again, where it's been for the last 2 years?
The decision's been made, I think because of the economic crisis, and that's the sort of the thing that we felt that we could have the most impact on, and bringing together the links between the economy and the economic crisis and the climate crisis, and how the two need to be tackled together and not separately in the way that the government has been trying to do it so far. And so that's why we're coming to London, because London is the heart of the economic centre of the country, but also globally, and it's also the carbon capital, if you like, of the world as well, because it's got huge carbon trading centre here as well, and so it's really important for us to tackle that head on.
Okay. Do you think that the regional climate camps, well, regional countries, Wales and Scotland, like, do you think that that has, they've started as a reaction to, a negative reaction to it being in the south of England again, or as a positive reaction as like a growing movement?
I'd say it's just, it's a positive thing. I mean, I think most of us within the Climate Camp movement have really wanted to see this kind of decentralisation, and it's brilliant to see that it's happening now. I think it's about kind of enthusiastic climate campers in Wales and Scotland loving the idea, loving the model, and starting it up, in their own patch. And long may that continue. So,
but do you not think that, like, the fact that for the last 3 years it has been in southeast England, like, do you not think that puts people from maybe northern England off going?
A really important thing to mention is the Northerners aren't losing out. They have a really gorgeous train of power stations on their doorstep, which is actually where we're going to be heading in October. So whilst it is true that the camp is in London, and we thought that was really important to link it to the economic system, the actions that we're going to be undertaking that we're going to need thousands of people to join us on are going to be in the north of England.
Okay, so you don't feel like that maybe those people would kind of do a different thing rather than climb a camp, or, you know, maybe, like, I mean, there's groups like Leave It in the Ground that will maybe be bigger up in the north than in...
And we did the coal caravan in the north of England, which I think was not... Well, of course, it's important to do the coal caravan where it's relevant, but I think it was an acknowledgement that we need to make sure that we're including everyone and that we're having events and actions up and down the country as close to people as possible, so that they feel like it is something that they own and they have control over.
I think something else important to mention here is the fact that, you know, obviously all climate camp decisions, you know, are made openly, and they're open to everyone at the monthly national gatherings, and I know that particular energy went into making sure that the feelings of people in the north were represented at those meetings where the decision on the location was made. So, you know, I really hope it is a decision which everyone within the Climate Camp movement feels comfortable with, and
Okay, all right, cool. Well, at the Climate Camp last year, you were there, I was there, and we were doing the radio. And one of the... big up us. Well done. And one of the... Well, one of the more interesting things that happened on the radio was that there was a letter circulating around the Climate Camp last year, which was sort of asking the question of whether Climate Camp was explicitly anti-capitalist or whether it sought to reform the capitalist system. And I was wondering, has there been any resolution or discussion of this issue at the national gatherings or otherwise?
I think there's been discussion, but not necessarily resolution.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's an ongoing debate within the Climate Camp movement, I think. And, you know, and again, it's a debate which is open for everyone. So, you know, anyone listening who's kind of got a perspective on this and, are obviously very welcome to come along and join in that debate. It's an ongoing thing, definitely. And there's a diversity of views within the movement.
Okay, but do you not see that, like, the sort of a lack of a commitment to any to that would sort of pandering to a broader base of people and trying not to scare people away with, like, anti-capitalist this and anti-capitalist that is sort of contributing to anti-capitalist movement in general, like, being seen as, like, a dirty thing, like, in the media and stuff like that. Even at the G20 in London, on April 1st, there was a distinct difference between not only how the media represented the two different protests, but how you presented yourselves as well. Like, that there was the anti-capitalist stuff going on at the bank, anarchist anti-capitalist, ooh, argy-bargy. And then there was the, fluffy sort of, you had trouble. But you know what I mean? Does you not think that by not being willing to commit to anti-capitalist sort of agenda that you're kind of marginalising other people within the same movement or whatever?
I think it's important to make sure we know what we're talking about, whether we're talking about the media representation of us and how we think we should be perceived and how we are being perceived and who's involved in, like, projecting the image, and
what it is actually that we are doing. Like, if people wanted to attend climate camp in the city, they were absolutely free to do that, and that was great that so many people turned up, and they attended for whatever reasons it is they have. And if they felt like their views were being embodied in the big discussions that we're all having, that's great. Like, and people chose which one to attend. Like, you're slightly missing out the fairly major fact that we're physically restrained from mixing between the two on the day, being shut up from the bank protest and then being shut in the climate camp.
But you did have very different media policies.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't too involved with the media work at that. I mean, I know a lot of, you know, I think there was a lot more crossover between the two groups at the G20 presences in the city than the media chose to represent. You know, and I think a lot of people made a particular effort to be involved in both so that there wasn't that kind of, you know, separating off.
Can you see, is this issue, like, is it on the agenda for climate camp? Is it something that you want to resolve, or is it something that is just going to continue to be unresolved? Or do you want to, do you see it needs to be resolved? Or?
I mean, I think, as far as I've seen of climate camp agendas, it's pretty often on the agenda, and I think we all know that it is a massive issue. It's a huge debate. I don't know if it will be resolved, but I think that the fact that we are targeting the economic system is it's progress towards that resolution. I think it's a really important step that Climate Camp is bringing together action on climate and on the economy and the economic system and the political system as well. So I think progress is being made, and again, people are, you know, really, really welcome to come and talk about it more, because we also really love to talk about these things. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd just emphasise as well that I hope we have got some really kind of radical messages on the economic system out into the media, you know, but we've had to do that within the mandate that's been given to us by Climate Camp national gatherings, you know. But I hope we have got that out there, and I think it's important to emphasise as well that, you know, Climate Camp is certainly somewhere, you know, is there between the kind of anti neoliberal perspective and you know, an anti-capitalist perspective. So it's not like it's sort of totally amorphous.
Okay. All right. Okay, all right, okay. Well, I think we kind of talked about that enough. So, just another sort of random sort of point is trying to tie it together. I won't bother. I'm not Terry Wogan. So, the Big Green Gathering was supposed to be last weekend. Was it last weekend? Yeah, supposed to be recently. Last weekend, I think. But it was shut down, basically, by the cops. Do you see yourselves as sort of... You obviously received a lot of police oppression, or we, last year at the climate camp, and of course this year at the city. So do you see that this is part of a general policy by the police now to kind of clamp down on alternative green gatherings and such? Do you see yourself as being part of the same struggle?
I think I can't speak for what is or isn't happening, especially because I don't know, but in my experience, it's like I've tried to get more involved with alternative green gatherings this year, and each one has been more and more held back by the police in different ways. That's been my personal experience, and it sometimes seems like you're jumping from one to the other, trying to work out what you can do within increasing police limits. And you do more and more get the feeling that you're somehow a criminal, and that, I don't know, for having a brick in your toilet cistern, you know, you're almost up there for terrorist offences. My personal experience and kind of attitude is definitely one that it's almost like we're being circled in on more and more.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think that Big Green Gathering seemed to be shut down because it was going to be a hotbed of climate activism and lots of people talking in a field. And I think that activists from Climate Camp and Plain Stupid and loads of other movements and organisations and groups were all going to be there. And it did seem like a pretty big attempt to shut that all down. On the other hand, it was good because it meant that a lot of people had free time to go down to the Isle of Wight and go and actually do direct action rather than just talking about it and planning for it at the Vestas factory and to be there for, I think there are people there from Climate Camps and obviously loads of other groups as well for the whole 2 weeks doing loads of really important stuff, and I think that it was a blessing in disguise for us. And so, you know, obviously really, really disappointed and angry that Big Green Gathering was shut down, but it was great because we got some extra free time to take action.
Okay, I guess the inevitable question, what do you think that your relationship with the police is going to be like this year? I mean, because obviously there was a lot of crap happened up in Kent last year, and then the G20, you kind of did an 11th hour kind of talking to the police and seeing what could happen with it when a dialogue was opened up, and then end up getting shafted. So, I mean, I guess what have you learned from that, and what is going to come of it this year?
Yeah, well, I went to a really interesting meeting with the police, actually, with some of the police liaison people a few weeks back, which was quite a weird experience. And I kept having, kind of visions of what happened in the city in April flashing before me as I was sat there kind of in this room at Scotland Yard. But so that was quite strange. But certainly they're kind of doing their best to sort of cozy up to us. And, you know, I think Climate Camp has done and I think the thing that Climate Camp's aware of is that the police are really, really scared by what happened in the city and the bad publicity that they got from that. And, you know, I know some people within Climate Camp have worked very hard to make sure that we see some real change as a result of what happened in the city. But yeah, certainly the game of how to go about police liaison is one that needs to be played carefully, and I'm sure the people who'll be doing that will be careful. But I would hope that as a result of kind of the shafting that the police got in the media after the Climate Camp in the city, they're going to be on slightly better behaviour. But you know, the proof is in the pudding. Let's wait and see.
But I mean, without giving too much away, do you reckon there would be any sort of concerted effort to keep the site police free, or are you just kind of going to be cosy enough that you're going to have a few friendly bobbies knocking around?
Yeah, that came up at the last national gathering, actually. That was an interesting discussion. My sense there was that there was very strong feeling against having police present on the site. Personally, I think there's pros and cons. I guess we'll wait and see what's decided this weekend at the National Gathering in Oxford, which, you know, again, anybody listening is very welcome to go along and attend and be part of that discussion. I'm sure that's going to be one of the hot topics discussed there.
Okay. We'll wait and see how they turn out. Yeah, so just to finish off, it's within the M25, that's all you're going to tell us.
That's all I think any of us here know. Yeah.
Go on.
honestly.
There was a confusion with a friend of mine. She thought it was going to be held on the M25 and asked, will I need a car to get there? Which I thought was slightly against what we do.
So are you ruling that out then?
It might be in a little chef.
Yeah. It might be in a little chef. Okay.
I think the main thing is that given that, you know, we certainly don't know, and the people that do know ain't going to give anything away, you know, people need to be prepared. And so, you know, make sure that on Wednesday the 26th of this month, you know, you're signed up to the text alert. You can sign up to that on the website, and you're ready and waiting at 12 o'clock to head off to the site and help, you know, the hundreds of other people to claim that site and make it a fantastic climate camp.
Yeah, and don't forget to bring a radio.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Why? Because we're doing the thing again, and we're going to have radio at it. not just internet radio. It's going to be great. So yeah, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
And best of luck with everything. And we'll see you there.
Absolutely, see you there.
So now we're going to have a track. Is this Depot's track, or did he just give it to you?
This is neither Depot's track nor the track he gave to me, because I'm going to play them later. So I'm going to play, this is Boy Clouds, and there you go. Yes. Okay. Yeah. That was Clouds, and that's the track. Anyway, right. Next is an interview that I did with Ian MacKay from the Anarchist FAQ. If you want to check out his book, it's online for free at anarchistfaq.something. Search it, you'll find it. It's easy, and you can also buy it, but it's free. So anyway, and I started off. This is the final part of the current batch of interviews I did with him, and I started off by asking him about work and what types of work would be maintained in a capitalist society or capitalist society, fucking anarchist society, and what jobs would be seen as superfluous. Do you like that word?
Good word.
Superfluous. Yeah.
headquarters. What is this, a dan?
A lot of jobs, people, and a lot of jobs in a society are created are not necessarily required. The whole banking industry, you know, that would go. The stock market, all that stuff, it's all unnecessary work. People make lots of money out of it, of course, and it's essential for the economy. But in terms of people's lives, its impact is negative. Currently, of course, in the current economic crisis, that's brought to a head. You know, it's helped destroy the economy. But even when it's meant to be working as it's meant to be working, it gives a lot of false information, false signals to productive activity, and it causes problems for ordinary people doing their ordinary lives. And all because it helps a few rich people control the economy and control the state and make themselves very rich. So it's a lot of work, so-called work, which just ceased to exist. A lot of industries that just ceased to exist in a free society, just be gone. You know what I mean? Like, you know, we don't want to put McDonald's under workers' control, so we'd have a McDonald's co-op. The whole idea of having sort of industrialised food like that would be gone. You know, people would, hopefully, they'd realise, like, you know, having an industrial food system is just bizarre and anti-ecological and somewhat repulsive as well. I mean, like, and they would seek to actually make food which is healthy and enjoyable and nice, which is very possible, rather than, like, you know, mass-produced crap you have to inject chemicals in to get a taste. Yeah. Fast Food Nation is a very good book, and it talks about the sort of industrialisation of the food process. They're using technology to solve the problems technology creates, all to make more money and sort of reduce costs. And it's, like, totally bizarre, but within the context of a capitalist system, perfectly rational. Looking at it from the outside, I just think, how can people be so mad to do this? But economically, within a system, it makes perfect sense. So you have a situation where the industrialised meat processing industry is so centralised that if you get a food contamination, then it spreads across the country, like, in a matter of weeks. And it's, like, just, like, people are dying because of it. And the solution, would it be, like, you know, sort of don't industrialise the meat processing industry, put it back to being a bit more sort of humane and sort of more local scale? No, irradiate the meat. And the major problem they think about irradiating the meat is because it's the PR problems with it. That's the only thing they think is wrong with it. But economically, it makes a lot of sense. Similarly, they have whole industries whose job is to make chemicals which puts the taste of things back into the meat and the foods that's been processed. It's like, we process the food so that it doesn't have a taste. We've got an industry which produces the taste chemically and puts it in for you. It's like, that's bizarre. Yeah, it's a very good book. It's just, like, opens your eyes up to, like, you know, how alienated humanity has become from, like, you know, it's just something as natural as growing and eating food. Previous societies, like, economic activity was embedded within society. Under capitalism, society, if it's lucky, is embedded in the market, in the economic system. You know, it's like economics comes first. Society, if it's lucky, gets somewhere mentioned along the lines. It's quite a reverse. Because people, I mean, obviously we've grown up in a society, people think this is the way it's always been, but it's not. I mean, the transformation in the last 300 years is just staggering. You know, a lot of it, some of it's been for good, a lot of it's been for bad. Hopefully we can build on the good bits and sort of, you know, use potential we've created to actually make life worth living and allow us to develop our full potential as individuals. Because obviously in a hierarchical society, people can't develop. They're not, you know, not in a situation to develop because people boss them about. They're not in a situation to be creative and think for themselves. So hierarchy corrupts everybody.
So here's the million-dollar question.
Yes.
When and how? Every little piece, does that contribute, or does it have to happen all at the same time? Or,
well, I mean, like, you know, there's sort of the whole thing about a transition society, you know, it's a transition state after revolution. But, you know, the transition starts now in what we do in the here and now. We have to act in a libertarian manner now, and that involves encouraging people to resist and fight back against exploitation and oppression now, you know, whether it be, like, you know, sort of patriarchy, sexist oppression, or racism, and so forth, or workplace exploitations, wherever oppression is, anarchy should be there to sort of fight against it and encourage people to fight against it. And by the very process of fighting against hierarchy, fighting against oppression, and fighting against exploitation, you change yourself a bit. you stand up, you gain the confidence to say, like, stop, I'm not going to do this anymore. And you also change yourself and you change your world a bit. And this process is going on all the time. And I mean, anarchists are not doing it. People, like, you know, resisting on and against the bosses all the time. Sometimes it flies up in a strike, like, for example, the Wildcat strikes just now in the oil industry, which have been somewhat distorted to imply it's sort of xenophobic, you know, sort of anti-foreign, I think, and it's much more complex than that. And most of it is to do with, like, the bosses treating all the workers like shit and trying to undercut all the workers, not just the British ones. So, I mean, obviously the media has been keen to portray it in terms of, like, nationalism, when in fact it's obviously a class issue, which has got some people involved that are doing with the sort of British jobs, British workers thing. But it's, I mean, yeah, solidarity work with, like, Polish immigrants and stuff is far more complicated than that. Obviously, you have situations in Gap when it gets noticeable, it's like in your face, but it's like every day people in the workplaces find the 5 minutes for themselves, or, like, resisting the bosses in ways we don't know about. So all that sort of process, people start to change themselves, start to change the world, and they start to create the mentality and the structures of a free society. So, for example, I'll talk about workplace. I don't want to sound like anarchists are totally focused on the workplace, because it's not the case. But that is a key issue, because that's where capitalism, you know, keeps going. That's where supply, that's where exploitation happens, where profits are made and so forth. So, we're talking about work. When people go on strike, for example, they could occupy the workplace, and you've got a strikers assembly there, which could be that is basically the end of strike committee, and that's the embryo of a syndicate, of the post-capitalist organisation. You've got, instead of a strikers assembly, you've got a workplace assembly. Instead of a strike committee, you've got a factory committee, a workplace committee. The area would be, like, sort of the aim to spread the strike, so you'd have a federation there of strike committees, which could be turned into a federation of workplace committees to manage the economy. And the community, for example, during the poll tax strike campaigns in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a whole network of community-based poll tax groups. And they did a lot of work in the communities, let people know about non-payment, what to do if the sheriff officers came around, bailiffs in England and Wales, sheriff officers in Scotland, you know, what the rights were and so forth. And all these local groups, they had public meetings in the community, they had federations of these. And all those could have been the embryo of the anarchist commune, the community assembly, the community federations. So people, by resisting exploitation and oppression now, they start to create the framework of free society. And more importantly, by that process of struggle, they start to free themselves and develop themselves and become capable of living as free individuals. So it's a process. Little bits of direct action here and there build up and build up and start to change things. And that's why the powers that be are so keen that people don't, very, very keen that people complain, but they're not so keen that people do things about it and, like, go on strike or protest and so forth. But it's why, because, you know, once people start to act for themselves, they gain the confidence and the ability to go further, to realise that, well, the boss needs us, but we don't need the boss. And that's the constant danger in hierarchical society, because ultimately, you have to keep people atomized, you have to keep people scared and afraid and, you know, not linked up in order to control them. But as soon as people start to link up and control them, then they start to see that another way is possible. Because people are pissed off, people are alienated, people know the system's not right. You know, to some degree, some people are more conscious of it than others. Some people, it's like a gut feeling. Other people are sort of more coherent analysis. And by fighting and by struggling, that gut feeling becomes a conscious feeling, and the potential ultimately is created where we can go beyond it and make a world fit for people rather than a world fit for profits and power. Sounds very utopian, doesn't it?
Because
we've lived through 30 in Britain, we've lived through 30 years of defeats. I mean, the poll tax was a glip in an otherwise steady stream of defeats. You know, Thatcher and mass unemployment,
minus,
for example, 25 years this year. Constant stream of defeats, people have become itemised. You know, the concept of taking to the streets and fighting, people don't see that as a possibility anymore. Even with a million people on the streets against the invasion of Iraq, didn't stop. where people do, you know, it's like the competence is lacking. In Britain, for example, talking to you like that is probably considered, like, people go, ah, yeah, right. And people are happy moaning but not happy doing anything. But you just go across to France, for example. You know, we take to the streets and protest all the time. I mean, there's a good line in Michael Moore's film Sicko, and they're talking about the healthcare in France, and an American there was saying, oh, in America, in France, it's different from America, because in France the government's scared of the people. In America, the people are scared of the government, and that makes all the difference. And that sense of, like, sort of standing up for yourself and saying enough's enough has been eroded in Britain. Not gone totally, but it has been eroded. But if you look in Europe, for example, we're the exception. All across Europe, people are standing up and fighting for themselves. Hopefully that can happen again. The task of anarchists is to encourage that process here. But, you know, it happens anyway without us. We just hopefully take part as equals, as fellow working class people, to try to change a struggle against exploitation, against oppression, into a struggle for freedom, and a struggle for equality, and a struggle for solidarity. Easy. That's what we aim to do. How successful we are is really up to us, and ultimately up to the people who are fighting and who are struggling. Because ultimately, we have an enormous power in our hands. Without us, without our brains and our muscle, the world come to a stop. And the bosses may need us, we don't need them. And once we become aware of that, things can change, and that's what we aim to encourage.
This is headquarters. What is this, a dance?
Charge, And now we're going to go into an interview that I did with two people from No Borders, Dan and Startex, who were at the recent camp in Calais that just took place. And basically, we just talk about, you know, the politics behind the camp and some very interesting stuff. So, yeah.
How it affects everyone. I mean, it is literally a refugee camp on our doorstep, like 100 miles from London. Certainly a lot of us felt it was really important to kind of show solidarity with people and what's going on over there. All our kind of border policy is connected, and the fact that these people in Calais are the same people who will hopefully will get over to Britain somehow, but they'll then be the people who are working in the crappy jobs for £2 an hour getting exploited. I think that's really important, the kind of interconnection between the two, because before the camp there were certain criticisms about, there's plenty of stuff going on in London and UK wide about migrants. We kind of say how linked that is with Calais, and Calais is really, it's almost like a extension of Britain. It's kind of almost the British border on the French side. I mean, even the French will describe it as a kind of special zone, which isn't really France, where general law and general rights, as they're so-called, exist, don't really apply to people.
I mean, British immigration policy has changed a lot in the last years. The policy around Calais was a very important part of it, and the main motivation to what's happening there is coming from the British side. For several reasons, for propaganda reasons, for practical reasons, the British government, Home Office, insists of putting repression on the migrants who come to Calais or to northern France. If I say Calais, I always mean northern France. There are several places which are like Calais. And it's very tightly connected to the immigration policies within Britain. When the French government and the British government made the agreement in 2002 to close Sangatte, part of this agreement was, for example, that Britain, on the other hand, makes sure that people are not going back to France after they get denied access to Britain. So that led to the massive expansion of the detention center system in Britain, still growing. What Dan said is completely correct. Calais is considered by the Home Office as a British border, as a British outpost. And the recent discussions about building a British detention center on that side of the channel shows that. If we say from the start, it has a quite long history. I mean, even at the times when Sangatte, the Red Cross camp, still existed before 2002, people were thinking of organizing some kind of transnational protest in Calais.
The tendency within No Borders has certainly been to fairly internal, like within the UK, and we really thought it was important to kind of organise on a transnational level, and that's often been spoke about in the past, but in reality it hasn't been so much, but this one was.
Well,
really,
the reason probably was that the contacts between activists in Britain and France weren't very, very good at that time. And again, maybe 2 years ago, after the protest camp in Gatwick Airport, we started investigating a bit more what's actually going on around Calais in northern France, because we found this a very important issue.
It's felt in Calais that there were groups on the ground doing really valuable work, like giving out food and stuff like that, but one, maybe their politics vary from ours, and two, they don't just have like the people power to do enough things that we thought was important to kind of go there and show a bit of support.
Originally, there was the idea of mainly establishing contact between groups, initiatives, organizations, and see if we can meet regularly sometime. And then we were actually really surprised how much response we got for that. And that was the reason why the idea came up of organizing a bigger protest, like a camp, for example.
Our message is basically about freedom of movement. Essentially, people should be free to cross whatever borders they want to. We don't believe in any of these borders, we're all artificial constructs. Along with that, there's also the kind of freedom to stay, and if people want to stay somewhere as well. I mean, I guess, you know, everyone in Calais or the migrants there are kind of clear about their aim, that they want to come over to the UK, and we wanted to show that we supported them in that. I mean, the people in Calais at the moment, the groups that are active, are doing really valuable work and giving out food and stuff. Sure, there's individuals in there who are thinking more about the politics and stuff, but a lot of people are just seeing it as a humanitarian issue where there's people who don't have food, they need to be fed. Well, obviously, it's not that simple.
I think generally we tend off making things relatively easy by saying, oh, some people came as refugees, they have nothing, and now they are in urgent danger, so they have to be rescued and come to UK. This is a very typical activist stereotype of what migrants are. We normally try to avoid the term refugees for these people, what migrants are. And if you talk to these people, and if you hear how they came to France, for example, and why they want to come to the UK, it teaches you a lot about what's actually going on in the world right now and how people actually cope with it. And I find this really impressive, because for me it is a part of resistance against the current system, like against the economic system, by defying it, by saying, oh, I actually claim my right to secure my living, not to have to be worried about what I'm going to live on tomorrow. Yeah. And how many things are involved in this, like the situations of traveling in different countries, the situation of cooperating with people you sometimes don't like. But on the other hand, these people are actually helping migrants a lot. It's a very complex issue, because there's nothing you can paint black or white and can say, oh, this is the good side and this is the bad side. It makes it very difficult and, on the other hand, very challenging. I mean, there are people in this world who are definitely refugees. People who live in a war area or something, and of course have to leave an area and they have no other choice. And as written, this exists, of course. But on the other hand, lots of people who migrate around the world go because they're seeking a better life. I mean, what the big difference for many people involved in No Borders to other humanitarian organizations or NGOs is very often that we take this as a justified reason to travel or to migrate. We don't say that you have to be persecuted in a state to migrate. If you want to migrate to Britain, and if it's for economic reasons, because you actually think you can live better here than in another country, this is your right, and we support that. Well, it was a kind of symbolic camp. I mean, it was symbolic because we've chosen a kind of activist kind of expression of protest. The interesting thing was that the camp itself didn't have any activist aim, in the sense of other protest camps, didn't have the aim of blockading something or doing specific actions or protesting very specific points. So it became a mixture of a kind of protest convergence and a place where people who work on the issue from different perspectives can come together. And especially the fact that so many migrants in the camps, migrants who sleep rough around Calais, was for me personally was a big success, because it was something we didn't really expect in the preparation phase. Because for many practical reasons, it's very hard to involve the migrants in preparing something like this. Many of them are staying only a few weeks in Calais, or sometimes 2 or 3 months. And then still we have to consider that these people have other worries than setting up toilets or water pipes or something. These people are there to come to Britain, and that's what occupying them all day. So.
The two most interesting features for me was, one, the migrants themselves were on the camp, where we had the camp, like migrants were living close by anyway. But there was consistently a group of migrants about, which was really nice, you know, in terms of, you know, solidarity, and we had some really good chats with people. And also later in the week, by the time we built all the infrastructure up, we had showers there and internet access, which was really good. And you know, obviously everyone was pleased, but the migrants especially, who showers is a big issue in Calais. And I think the other main thing which was good was interaction of the local people as well. It was kind of on the east side of Calais, in quite a poor area, and the locals, people from that neighbourhood, kind of really interacted with the camp, which was nice, and certainly it was quite unexpected. And actually getting the migrants and the local people were, you know, interacting, playing football and stuff together, which doesn't really happen. So it was kind of nice that everyone could be brought together and on that kind of one-to-one level. Whereas obviously, as we know, like in the media, and that's always kind of demonising everyone, these evil migrants living in the jungle coming to attack everyone and steal your houses. The other was the, not unexpected, but the kind of ridiculous police presence. As I said, it wasn't unexpected, but I think that it caused a lot of annoyance among the local people. It helped us in a way. There was all this sort of stuff in the media, mainly the local press, like these crazy masked up terrorists are going to come and leave your town. And then obviously the reality is very different. We took a trip out to get rid of some recycling, and then some guy from the allotment invited us in and was discussing about how he wasn't so keen on the police himself, and gave us all this free food and was feeding us, gave us some crazy little shot of liqueur. So it was nice.
I think the mere fact that we came together in the camp changed our perspective on how we can access the problem. I mean, of course, we all kind of constantly fell into the stereotypes of saying, oh, the migrants, the activists, the humanitarian groups. I think if you work for a while with people, you try to start to understand why they're doing things like this. And especially in a situation like Calais, you get a much better understanding of how complex it is to help there. As we're talking about people here, like people you can meet, people who face repression every day, it changes a lot about your perspective, how you do or how you consider yourself as an activist, which is very different for me from doing other things where you do a lot of symbolic actions or campaign on a wider level of politics.
What is the jungle like in Calais, and what is the situation there? Like, how precarious is it, and what's the living situation like?
It's hard to describe. I mean, we talk about 800 to 1,500 people sleeping rough all over the place. They're quite isolated from the locals in Calais, which is partly because people are a bit afraid of what's going on there. On the other hand,
the jungle is kind of due to the nature, series of different camps. It's on the northeast bit of Calais, kind of in the industrial area, and it's kind of split into a number of different camps on kind of national and ethnic lines, and it's quite hierarchical. But yeah, I mean, they get a lot of harassment from the police. They just come in snatching people or gassing, trying to gas people out of their tents, tear gas.
I mean, yeah, the living conditions are rough. I mean, we talk about people who sleep in the openness for weeks, and these are people who already travelled for several months normally before they came. Oh no, if you want to phrase it positively, you could say also that on the other hand, these people are basically almost close to where they wanted to go. So lots of them are actually high motivated and high spirit, because they actually had sometimes tougher things they already survived in the last few months. So I found a lot of energy and a lot of motivation and enthusiasm to talk to us and to talk to people and to kind of learn about the situation here. Mm-hmm. The situation was always in the last 6 years was always bad for the migrants in northern France. It became worse after Sarkozy became president, mainly for propaganda reasons. He kind of had to initiate kind of repressive steps against the migrants. And on the other hand, the British government, they're doing their best to put repression on the people. The other thing which worries us is the massive repression against activists in the area, which is against anybody who tries to set up any political or humanitarian support. Many of the humanitarian groups who do food distribution, etc., they face repression by the police. They get hassled by the police or by the authorities constantly. I have big respect that they still manage to maintain that. Mm-hmm. And if we can help with this as well, then that's a big step forward, I think. I mean, Calais, as I said, is in so far a symbolic spot as it's the most known border point to Britain. But everything we say about Calais is a similar situation in the area of, for example, Dunkirk, or along the coast of northern France, wherever there's a harbour. However, we have to say that the amount of people, we talk here about like 10, 12,000 people a year, maybe 15,000 who come, of which maybe 8,000 come to the UK, maybe 10,000, which is a ridiculously low number if you compare it to the immigration, emigration from the UK. So we overall talk about a very symbolic issue from the perspective of immigration policies. And if you see how intensively the Home Office deals with this problem and how much effort they put in putting repression on those people, plus maintaining such high-level propaganda against them, we think that it is a very important struggle which is going on right now. And for us it is a struggle which is going, a social struggle which is going on around the UK. Yeah, it is on one hand, it is a ridiculously low number if you see it in the overall immigration figures. Especially the Home Office tries to show this as an example of how they maintain or how they manage migration. The other interesting aspect for us is that lots of these people who finally reach the UK, I mean, most of them are going to stay around London for practical reasons. Lots of these people we will meet years again later because they work as undocumented migrants in low-paid or almost not-paid jobs. It's very strongly or very closely connected to other things we do around campaigning for migrant workers' rights in London. I mean, many of these people get exploited in very badly paid jobs later, and they're playing a big part in the London economy. Yeah, I mean, especially London relies, London so much relies on undocumented workers from all over the world. I mean, in the cleaning sector or in the local transport sector. And I mean, bizarre enough, I mean, or absurd enough, it is the same companies like the big service companies like Sodexo, etc., who run the detention centers and do the deportations later on for the same people. But the mere fact that, I mean, people without travel documents or passport or whatever you call it are part of this society in a huge number, and that these people should have the access to the same rights. And rather than claiming that they should get a passport or something, to say everybody who's here should have the same rights, anybody who's here, I think this should become a much stronger focus of political campaigning. I think we lost in the last years, I think we lost a bit the focus of why we originally started campaigning around what is called illegal immigration or whatever. I think we lost the focus a bit of telling people that these people have a right to come here and have a right to come even illegally if they have other chance to come into the country, and they have hardly any chance to come into this country.
Mm-hmm. All right, yeah. Shout out to G. Hanging out. G Dog.
G.
G. G Wiz. G G. Double G. Coming at you. All the way. Whitechapel to Kent. Love from the Brinster and all. Yeah, where are the paint rollers? And what's this big, big politician starting the music hour? Enjoy.
Pollution out on the street, yeah. Out on the street now. My little brother got dead shot, yes. My little sister, my dead God, love. My
my daddy has to run to the bar. My mother can't take on the star. Oh no, 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 cause it's a big, big pollution. My brother, it's a big, big pollution. My sister, it's a big, big pollution. Out on the street, out on the street, yeah. Killing and shooting and robbing and stabbing, it can never stop. What was from the beginning, it shall be in the way, my friend. Cause it's a big, big pollution. My brother, it's a big, big pollution. My sister, it's a big, big pollution. Out on the street, out on the street, it's a big pollution. Oh yeah. My dad get shot, yes. My daddy have to run to the bar, Lord. My mother can't take on the stock. My sister might get caught. Oh Lord, Lord, Lord. Cause it's a big, big pollution. My brother, it's a big, big pollution. My sister, it's a big, big pollution. Out on the street, yeah. All I can see, all I can see, is my little brother them dying. Oh Lord, all I can see, all I can see, is my little sister them crying. Yes, 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 yes. It's a big, big pollution. My brother, it's a big, big pollution. My sister, it's a big, big pollution. Out on the street. Out on the street, out on the street, it's a big pollution. We'll be right back.
pollution. My sister, it's a big, big pollution. Out on the street, come and make we have some fun. Sweet Roots music, you could never refuse it. Yeah. Run, come on quick, and I try no funny trick. Run, come on quick, even with your walking stick. Sweet reggae music, I could not refuse it. Whether you're young or you're old, you got to let a good time roll. Good for the make we have some fun. See, run, come on, make we have some fun. Sweet reggae music, how could you ever refuse it? Good for the young and the old, you got to live a good time, roll. Rock to it, yeah, you can. Skank to it, you can. Walk to it, you can do anything you want.
grind this tape when I'm finished. None of us make it. At least there'll be some kind of record. Nobody trusts anybody now. Nobody trusts anybody. Nothing else I can do. Just wait. We'll be right back.
Thank you. cages. Sometimes me sing song. We know, fear of no sound. We know, fear of no fear. Bad boy, you turn a bad boy, you country. If a sound boy, this him a cut the damn berry.
the center of power. Thank you. detention center on Island. I was gassed for 3 days. One for 5 hours, one for 8 hours, and then on Sunday for 3 hours in the morning.
Wait, what happened?
Thank you very much.